This is Amerinds. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. This is Arthur, a gay American now living in New Zealand, and welcome to episode 56 of my podcast for Friday, November 23rd, 2007. As I'm recording this, it's still Thanksgiving Day in America, but of course for us, the fourth Thursday in November was yesterday, and it was just an ordinary Thursday. However, I did manage to have a bit of a Thanksgiving yesterday, after all, but today is just an ordinary Friday. We're not doing any sort of Thanksgiving dinner. Nigel's sister and niece aren't free anyway, so we're just going to have a normal Friday, and that means I've got time to do a podcast. But since it is Thanksgiving Day in America, and because most of my listeners are in America and have a holiday weekend, I thought I would just do kind of a one topic, more focused thing today, and just talk about what Thanksgiving is for me, and also, of course, what I just had as a Thanksgiving. And I'll resume to normal podcasts on Tuesday, including comments. I've got a lovely voicemail message from Nick in Paris that I'll save for Tuesday's episode. But as I said, Thursday was an ordinary day. And as you may remember, Thursday is the day I have the part-time job. However, one of Nigel's sisters had arranged for all of us to go to an evening with a psychic, along with 1,000 other people. And she is one of three psychics they use in a TV series called Sensing Murder, which I believe is based on a British series, if I remember correctly. But what they do, essentially, is they take these unsolved cases, usually murders, but I don't think always. I think sometimes it's just disappearances. And they bring in two psychics to work on that case, and then they come up with their impressions, and they try to basically decide who did it and how they did it and those sorts of things. And if they uncover any new evidence, they turn it over to the police. Now, I have to say that I have the same skepticism about psychics and paranormal abilities as I do about anything else supernatural, including religion. And that is that I don't dismiss it out of hand, but neither do I necessarily buy into it. I'm skeptical to the extent that I don't buy into it, but I'm not a knee-jerk skeptic. I don't automatically dismiss it as nonsense either. I'm open to being persuaded, but I'm not easy to persuade, you could say. I have what I consider to be a healthy skepticism. And some people may consider that to be a bit more hard-nosed than I need to be, but hey, that's just the way it is. However, when you see this show Sensing Murder, it is almost uncanny some of the things that they can come up with. The show is structured very carefully, where the psychics in the episode aren't told any details about the case that they're pursuing or when it happened or anything. And it's compared to realities in the editing afterwards. They don't tell the psychic anything up front, and even while they're filming them, they don't tell them if they're right about anything. The people filming the psychic as they're talking says absolutely nothing. The reason I mention that is because one of the criticisms that's made of psychics doing this sort of thing is that they take subtle visual or verbal cues from the person they're talking to in order to refine what they're saying to make themselves sound more accurate. Now, I don't know if that's true generally or not. That is a criticism that's been leveled, but it's unlikely to be going on in this TV series because of the way they've structured it to make it virtually impossible for them to pick up any clues or cues or anything like that. In the show, or whatever you want to call it, last night, there was more of an opportunity for that sort of thing to go on, but they had a camera that was trained on the face of the person in the audience that she was talking to. Her name's Deb Weber. She's an Australian. And I couldn't see any subtle visual clues, and a lot of the people were, well, they're fairly typical Kiwis, pretty stoical, and they weren't saying a lot, you know, giving a lot of verbal mm-hmm or anything like that. And so I couldn't really tell, but periodically they would say, yes, that's right, those kinds of things, because, I mean, there comes a point where you have to say something. So I don't know. I wasn't blown away with how bizarrely accurate it was, but neither did I sit there thinking, this is fake, oh, this is stupid. I was, as I usually am, somewhere in the middle. Not totally convinced, but not unconvinced either. But that was our evening for the Thursday evening. And I theoretically could have gone to work and then just gone directly to the theater and met them there and had the show. However, they were all planning on meeting at Denny's. which there's one in our city, which is called North Shore City. There's a few in the Auckland region and a couple of others in other parts of New Zealand, as I recall. But I can't remember if I mentioned in the podcast or not, but certainly I've said this in my blog. Nigel and I, in at least one other Thanksgiving, had gone to Denny's because their menu is largely the same as you'd find at an American Denny's, including their turkey dinner. And, I mean, it's just diner food. You don't expect to have, you know, haute cuisine. But I thought it was pretty decent for diner food. And it was a heck of a lot easier than making it myself. So that's what I had. Or that's what I wanted to have, I should say. I wanted to be part of this. But this job was in the way. Now, I could have gone in extra early yesterday morning. But I couldn't get a hold of them to find out if that was okay, because I didn't want to just assume. And so I decided I'd just go into my normal time, but I was going to take the bus. Well, I haven't said this before, but my most arrogant hangover, or holdover, I suppose you should say, from being American, is to tell people that Auckland has no public transport system, no rapid transit in Auckland. And that's technically not true, because there are trains, there are ferries that crisscross the harbors, there's buses over the entire region. But the system is so shambolic and so poorly organized and poorly scheduled that from my perspective, coming from Chicago, it might as well not have a public transport system for all the good it was. Well, that was reinforced for me yesterday. The nearest bus stop to our house is up you have to go up the street we actually live on and up another road way up. About halfway up is a bus stop. Now, a lot of the streets in North Shore City are actually on hills. Sometimes they run along the crest of a hill, but more often than not, it seems they're going up the side of the hill. And when I say hill, I actually mean mountain. These suckers are steep. So my legs were burning before I got to the bus stop, and I was winded. And I know, I should be in better shape, blah, 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 but I wasn't. And that didn't help me yesterday. So I got to I was near the bus stop, but not near enough. There was a bus that was stopped, and not my bus, but another one. And the bus I wanted roared past. It didn't even pull into the bus stop. And that, of course, happened to me in Chicago, so why should it surprise me that it happened here? So, because I didn't hear it coming. I couldn't hear with the bus that was sitting there idling. So I had to go up to the next bus stop, where there's buses from different directions. And that's even further uphill. But I made it, and I had to wait about 10 minutes or so for the next bus. To get to where I work, the area where the job is called Eden Terrace, which I know means nothing to you, but it's outside of the central city. And the center part of a city in New Zealand is usually called the CBD, or Central Business District. The way the buses in Auckland are mostly structured is that you've got to go into the CBD, into the center city, and take another bus out to get to somewhere. You can't just cross the city in a bus to get there. There are none. Now, in my case, there is a bus that goes from this transport place nearby, it's called Varen's Corner, that will go reasonably close to where I work. And when I say reasonably, I mean it's like a 20-minute walk where the bus stop is, 15, 20 minutes. But there are only three buses that head that way in the morning and then three buses that head back in the afternoon. And if, of course, you miss those, you're out of luck. So what it's actually faster to do is to take a bus into the city, walk about 5 minutes downhill, catch another bus out of the city again, back to where I work, and then walk about another five minutes or so to the door of where I work. However, it takes a good 15 minutes to get to this bus, to walk to this bus stop in the first place, all uphill. And that was what nearly did me in. And I have to say, it reminded me why I hate taking the bus in Auckland, because it's just, at least from the shore, because it's so hard to get to a bus stop. It's almost inevitably uphill, and it doesn't go where you want to go, or when you want to go. However, be that as it may, I persevered, and I got to work actually a bit earlier than I'm supposed to be there, which actually was quite a bit earlier than I'm normally there, because I don't normally make it on my supposed start time. There was nothing to do, as is typical, and so I ended up leaving at about 4:45. Nigel came and collected me, so I only got about 6 hours in, roughly. And we went direct to Denny's, where I had my turkey dinner, as I wanted. And then we went on to the evening with Deb Weber. All things considered, that had to have been the weirdest Thanksgiving I've ever had. First of all, working on a Thanksgiving, which I certainly wouldn't do in America, obviously. But taking the bus in, which is not normal behavior for me, leaving after only about 5 or 6 hours or whatever it was, and then going to a Denny's, and then from there to the psychic thing, and not getting home until till after 11. It was a long day, certainly, and a very unusual day. But that was my Thanksgiving for 2007. Last time, I talked a bit about what I would do for Thanksgiving, including buying this turkey roll, which is, as I said at that time, just turkey breast, essentially, and make a roast dinner with potatoes and vegetables and kumara, which it's a kind of sweet potato, but it's different from what Americans think of when they think of sweet potato. Similar, but it is different. And things like that. But I haven't had a pumpkin pie in 12 years. And I was thinking about making one. Well, since we're not doing Thanksgiving here at the house this year, I'm going to have to wait for another Thanksgiving to try that. Although I was talking to my sister-in-law, and I think I might try making one for Christmas instead. But we'll see. We'll see if I'm feeling up to it. I really should experiment a couple times before I try to inflict it on anybody else to try to get it right, because I do have to make the pumpkin puree from scratch before I can make the pie. Also today, I put up a blog post about Thanksgiving and what it feels like as an expat for Thanksgiving. And my blog is at amrins.com, by the way. And that also has a link to last year's post, which is called Thanksgiving Down Under. And I talk a little bit more about the specifics of how I manage Thanksgiving, living on the other side of the planet from my homeland, and being unable to get some of the things from my homeland. Some of the things that I talk about in those two posts I've already talked about either today or in episode 55. But if you want to read more about that, by all means, check out those blog posts, because they will give you a bit more detail about what's going on. Another thing I wanted to mention about Thanksgiving was that yesterday, which was the fourth Thursday in November, the U.S. ambassador to New Zealand, a guy named Bill McCormick, was at the Methodist Mission in Wellington, which is, of course, where the embassy is in the capital. And he was apparently helping serve up turkey dinners for 150 people, I think it was. And the Methodist Mission is essentially a soup kitchen. Auckland City has one. I think Christchurch City has one. It also has a food pantry and a bunch of other social programs as well. Now, I'm not quite clear on who actually paid for this Thanksgiving dinner, if it was the U.S. Embassy or him personally or somebody else. I don't really know. But he was certainly there helping serve it up. And I have to say that if he had had the fortune of serving for a better president, that he could have done a lot to promote goodwill towards the U.S. I've seen him three times, well, actually twice on television, and this is the third thing I've seen of him. They've all been very positive. Last year on Thanksgiving, for instance, he appeared on the Good Morning program on TV One, which is a three-hour-long entertainment and infomercial extravaganza, which actually, if you want to, you can always look at online at tvnz.co.nz. In Americanese, that's tvnz.co.nz. And keyword, good morning, and you can get there and probably watch the whole thing online. At any rate, last year he and his wife were on, and they presented their recipes for stuffing and talked about Thanksgiving traditions. And he had been on before, and I've frankly forgotten what it was for now. But he's very friendly and very affable and kind of the smiling face of America, kind of what you'd want in an ambassador. He's a millionaire seafood restaurateur from America's West Coast somewhere. I'm not quite sure where he's from. And like most ambassadors, he got the job because he gave lots of money to the Bush campaign. That's how ambassadors get their positions. They give lots of money to the presidential candidate who appoints them. But he is one of the best that I've seen since I've been in New Zealand, and I've seen several come and go, including Carol Mosley Braun, who was the former senator from my home state of Illinois, and who I actually voted for senator, I have to say, in 1992. But she was defeated for re-election amid various allegations, and President Bill Clinton appointed her as his final ambassadorial appointment to New Zealand. And when Bush came in, he appointed his ambassador, and I can't remember now who it was, but I remember that one of them was named Charles Swindles. And I thought, ooh, does he now? It's just terrible. You shouldn't make fun of people's names. Don't do that. But this Bill McCormick was, it was a really decent thing to do. Whether or not it made anybody feel any better about America or not under the circumstances, I don't know, probably not. Because America has got such such animosity toward it these days that I don't even think a nice ambassador can make up for it. But if anybody could, he probably could. He's a credit to our country. Now, in the news, completely unrelated to Thanksgiving, there's just a couple things I wanted to tell you about because they relate to New Zealand and the things that you probably or may not hear about in the U.S. in particular. First of all, Pakistan has been suspended from the Commonwealth. Now, the Commonwealth, of course, is made up of 53 nations that used to be part of the British Empire. The exception is Mozambique, which joined on its own. And currently there are two nations that are suspended, Pakistan and Fiji Islands. And Fiji, both of them are under military dictatorships at the moment, and both are suspended pending the restoration of democracy. Now, the U.S. is reluctant to do anything about Pakistan because it doesn't want to topple the Musharraf regime and therefore hand nuclear weapons to terrorists, or at least Islamic extremists. And all of that is perfectly understandable. And so maybe in that sense, the Commonwealth is just, I don't know, putting additional pressure onto the Pakistani regime without actually doing anything that's going to matter. The Commonwealth is a fine association. It in some ways is better than the UN because it gets more stuff done. However, it's not as powerful as the UN is even. It doesn't have peacekeeping troops, for instance. It can coordinate activities among Commonwealth nations, but it doesn't actually carry them out. So some of the peacekeeping duties that have been done, say in the South Pacific, have been done perhaps with help and support from the Commonwealth, but not actually a Commonwealth activity. Be that as it may, I just think it's kind of interesting that the Commonwealth has taken that action, and it's until Musharraf resigns from the military and ends the rule by decree or whatever he's calling it. And those are things that the U.S. says he's about to do anyway, which means that Pakistan can relatively quickly be restored to the Commonwealth. But we'll see what happens. But also in Commonwealth news, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting is about to start in Uganda. And there's a pre-meeting that happened beforehand, which is where this suspension was decided. And the Queen, as the head of the Commonwealth, came to Uganda to open the meeting of Commonwealth Heads of Government, which is commonly known as CHOGM. It's held here in Auckland, 96, I think? Maybe 97? I can't remember now. It was a while ago anyway, when National was still the party of government. So among other things, she toured a hospital where there were patients living with HIV/AIDS, and the media was making a big deal out of how she shook the hand of this man there, as her late daughter-in-law Diana had done about 20-odd years ago. Now, there's two ways you can look at this. One is you can be cynical and say, what took her 20 years to do it? Or it's just a publicity stunt, or it's meaningless. But the fact of the matter is that she's an 81-year-old grandmother. She has nothing personal to gain anymore by shaking the hands of someone with AIDS. And I say if she draws some attention to the plight of African nations and their struggle with AIDS, all the better, because it's something that certainly needs to be brought to the attention of the world. And, you know, I'm not willing to criticize her on that because I think that the end result is what matters in this case. And also in the Commonwealth, this is my theme now, the Australian elections are tomorrow. And the polls are all over the place. Some polls are suggesting that the Labour Party, the Australian Labour Party, or ALP, will win in a landslide. And another poll that was released says that the coalition, which is made up of the Liberal Party, which is John Howard leads, which is not actually liberal liberal in 19th century sense. It's actually a conservative party. And its coalition partner, the National Party, which is mostly rural, that they still have a chance of gaining government. And I honestly don't have a clue what is going to happen, which party is going to win. By the time that Americans are waking up on Saturday, the results will probably be fairly obvious as to what's going on, as to what's happened. Now, the coalition, as the government is called, the Liberal Party, National Party coalition government, has said that 13 of the Australian Labour Party candidates are ineligible to serve in Parliament, which means that if they do lose the election, they're probably going to go to court to challenge the results, and they could force 13 by-elections to come up with a new MP for those electorates, which means that, theoretically anyway, Australia could be in turmoil for months to come. But we'll see. I don't know that any of that's going to happen, and it could very well be that if the Australian Labor Party wins, that it could win with more than enough seats so that even those 13 wouldn't matter, in which case the whole thing is pointless. But, you know, we'll see what happens. I'm not convinced that the Australian Labor Party is going to win. John Howard is a crafty old buzzard, and he has managed to pull elections out of his ass several times now. And he is certainly a politician who's managed to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. He has had Karl Rovian zeal, you could say, for his re-election. In the last campaign, he managed to federalize the issue of gay marriage in order to use it as a wedge issue. And I wouldn't rule him out, is what I'm saying. Whether he will be able to pull it off, I don't know. He's trailing in the polls in his own electorate seat, which means that he personally could be defeated for re-election, but his coalition government could be re-elected, which means that they would select somebody else to be prime minister because he would no longer be in parliament. But I honestly don't have a clue what's going to happen because I don't have enough sense of the way Australian elections work. I can tell you that they are completely different from either the U.S. or Australia or New Zealand in the way that they select the members for the lower house. And of course, that's where the prime minister comes from. In Australia, they use a system called STV, or single transferable vote. And what happens is you're presented with your ballot paper with a list of candidates. And you put a 1 by the candidate that you most want, and a 2 by the one you want next, and a 3, and so on. You rank them, essentially, from 1 to however many there are. And if the one you want doesn't have enough votes to win, then they take the ones with the least votes first, and they knock them out, and they redistribute the votes, and they keep doing that until they end up with one candidate who ultimately wins. It's a complicated system. It's argued that it is more fair than any other system because it gives you a variety of options instead of making you choose essentially between 1 or 2 people. Our system in New Zealand is called MMP, or mixed member proportional, and it is completely different again. I hesitate to talk about that in the Australian context because I think it'd just be too confusing. But essentially, it's unlike any other system I've ever seen anywhere, certainly. It's used in New Zealand for some elections, like some district health boards, for instance, use them. I don't think any councils do at present. I'm not sure about that, so don't quote me on that one. Some local government elections may be run under that system. I'm not positive. But it takes longer to count the votes when you've got that system because you've got to keep winnowing them down until you get one winner in the end. And then, of course, Australia is so big that by the time you get to Perth on the Indian Ocean, a lot of time has passed and the polls have been closed in the eastern seaboard for a very long time. Western Australia is allegedly, and I don't know if this is still true, but at any rate, it was once the world's largest electorate. And it may still be for all I know. But it's a fascinating country. And I think I'll talk more about the elections themselves after they're all over. So I'll talk about them on Tuesday's podcast. And that's all I wanted to tell you about today. Leave a comment on my blog, which is at amarins.com, or send an email to me at amarins@yahoo.com. And of course, you can always leave a comment on my listener line, which is 206-339-8413. That's a U.S. number, of course. And I'll have comments from this show and episode 55 on my Tuesday podcast. But by all means, comment. I'd love to hear from you and love to have the conversation that we have together. The closing music today is by the Alice Project from the Podsafe Music Network. And it's called Regifting for the Holidays. I thought it was appropriate with Black Friday and the shopping frenzy that's being unleashed. And it's another way, perhaps, of dealing with the need to give gifts. That's all for this episode, and I'll see you again on Tuesday. Bye.